Well, Andy Barnes has a PhD in English literature and an MFA in creative writing. His nonfiction has appeared in Broad Street, The Away Journal, Gertrude Press, and Sheep's Head Review. His academic book, Post-Closet Masculinities in Early Modern England, was published by Bucknell University Press in 2009. He lives in New York City and is the author of Dark Eclipse, which we'll discuss this morning. Andy Barnes, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you for having me. Good morning.
Good morning.
Sounds like it's raining and foggy there.
Yeah, it is. It's kind of a typical winter day for us.
So. Yeah.
Oh, well. A reminder for our listeners this morning, you can join our conversation by calling 800-838-3760, or you can email us at jx@jeffnet.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at Jeff Exchange. I guess I wanted to just start this morning with a brief caution for some of our viewers. We'll be talking about suicide today, and if you're sensitive to that, just be advised. Andy, I wanted to ask you about your book, and the official title is The Dark Eclipse, Reflections on Suicide and Absence, and this
is
about your brother Mike and your family relationships. The first question I had, as you were, several years had passed from the time that he had died. Initially, were you just kind of on a quest to learn more information about what happened, or did you intend to write a book?
I didn't necessarily in the beginning intend to write a book, although I am a writer, so I did think about writing a book, but in the beginning, Mike's suicide, and he died in 1993, was just a trauma that I had to survive, a trauma that I had to go through without really processing why or what had happened. I think the reason it took me so long, it took me 20 years to write this book, and I wrote many versions of this book before I got to this one. The reason I finally got to where I am today is because of time and distance from that trauma that allowed me to look at the facts of Mike's death in order to try to understand the reason for his death.
I was, as I read your book, and there's a number of different stories that weave together here, and they can't be separated, but I'd like to start off with maybe a discussion of the facts of the case, the suicide, and then maybe later take a deeper dive into some of the family issues and relationships.
Sure.
Let me start off by asking, how did you learn about your brother's suicide?
That's a good question. I got a call a few days before they found Mike from one of his friends, and the friend had called me and asked me if I knew where Mike was. And I said, no, why? And then they said that he couldn't be found, although they also told me that it wasn't unusual for Mike to disappear for a couple of days without telling his friends. But it did raise an alarm. And then a few days later, I got a call from one of my brothers to say that the police had found Mike in a hotel room in Times Square.
And in your book, you write, and I can't quite remember if it was just you who went with your parents to the morgue. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And relate to us that whole experience. You know, as I read it, it kind of felt, I've never been in a situation like that, but it felt kind of surreal, your experience that you had.
It was completely surreal. So I came out to New York. I wasn't living in New York at the time. I was living in Minneapolis at the time. I flew out to New York, and the night before, my parents flew out, and the three of us went to the morgue here in Manhattan, and we were placed in a waiting room, and it was a very tense between my parents and me. We had known that Mike had committed suicide. My father knew that I was gay. They knew that my brother Mike was gay as well, and while we were waiting for the ME. To come to us. My father, who was quite agitated and a very sort of moralistic person, I guess we could say, he came up to me, pointed a finger at me, and said, anyone who lives this kind of lifestyle deserves to die this way, which was very difficult, obviously. I took it as my father putting a curse upon me and putting a curse upon his dead son, who we were about to bury. So it was hard to process at that moment, but it didn't surprise me that my father had said this. My father had a very difficult time having gay sons, two gay sons, in a family of seven boys and one girl, a very sort of patriarchal family, you might say, a very male-centric family, to have two gay sons was anathema to all that he believed in.
At the morgue, is that where you were presented with your brother's suicide note?
Well, after the morgue, we had gone over to the police precinct, Precinct 18 here in Manhattan, where that covers Times Square, because that is where my brother was found. And so we went over to collect his belongings. And this is where I begin the book, is me present day, or actually a couple of years ago, standing in front of that police precinct, going in there to ask for the police report. And it brought back a lot of memories, because back in 1993, when my parents and I went there, a policewoman grabbed my arm and took me into a side room. And there she presented me with Mike's suicide note that was written on hotel stationery, and she asked me to read it. And in that suicide note, with which I begin this book, actually, in that suicide note, he declares that he has HIV, or that he's sick. He doesn't say that he has HIV, and that he is also gay, which my parents knew. And the police woman asked me, "Do your parents know this?" And my first response was, "What does it matter now?" But the police woman also said, "Well, he wrote a really nice note. Your parents will like it." And they certainly did like it. I, on the other hand, was appalled by it, because he denounced everything it was to be gay, and in so he was also denouncing me.
And your brother at this point was HIV positive, is that correct?
That's what he declares, and there's another document that I use in the book that he wrote a year before he died, called The Salient Facts of Patient Michael J. Barnes. And in it, he details every single illness he had in that year, from strep throat to fatigue to... And at the end of this, he says that he went and got an HIV test and he was positive. I don't know whether that's true or not, because my brother was a hypochondriac. He was given to lying. So I don't know. When they did the autopsy, they didn't test him for the virus. So I don't know that he was, but he declared that he was, and this was one of the reasons why he committed suicide.
We're speaking this morning with Andy Barnes. He is the author of the book, The Dark Eclipse, Reflections on Suicide and Absence. You can join our conversation by calling 800-838-3760 or sending us an email to jx@jeffnet.org. We're going to take a short break and then be back with more questions for Andy Barnes. We're speaking this morning with Andy Barnes. He is the author of The Dark Eclipse, Reflections on Suicide and Absence. Andy, you mentioned that the suicide note brought some comfort to your parents, but not to you.
That's right.
As you've read the suicide note and sort of processed that over the years, did it answer some of your questions, or did it leave you with more questions?
That's a good question. It did both, I guess I would say. What I think my brother did was that he tried to create a different kind of life, a different narrative in which he could live, because he didn't like, in the end, living in the narrative or the true self that he was living. For example, after he died, I found out from some of his coworkers that he had told people that he was an only child, that he was an orphan, that my parents had died young. So he was trying in New York to create a different kind of life, and I really think in the end he couldn't live in that story, as I talk about in the book. And I think the suicide note is also part of that fantasy life, because again, in the suicide note, he declares that he wishes more than anything he could be a married man living back in Indianapolis with all my other brothers who are married with children. And so I think he was trying to create something different. So I don't know if it helped me to understand why he died, other than internalized homophobia. That certainly was part of it. But I think he also wrote the suicide note to do exactly what it did, that is to give comfort to my parents.
So he was living a really conflicted life in his own perception of himself, is what you're saying.
I think that's right. Although in Manhattan, where he lived for a number of years, he was an openly gay man. Everybody knew, except at work, after all his friends, he had gay friends. So he's living this gay life. But I think there was so much pressure when we were children that the only valuable life was a life in which you married and had children. That was the only valuable life. Any other life was less than. And that's something that both Mike and I had to carry with us through our childhood. Mm-hmm. What made my childhood very difficult, our teens and 20s and into our adult life. And I think I was able to overcome that, and my brother Mike was not. He succumbed to that.
Have your feelings about his death changed over the years, especially when you went back and you did this sort of deep dive into some of the details?
Yes and no. When Mike died, suicide is a very violent way to die. And the violence inflicts wounds on those of us who survive. And I think that for listeners who've had experience with people who have committed suicide, it's first of all okay to be angry with that person who killed themselves. And I was quite angry, and I still do get angry that he did this without thought for those of us who were left behind, as it was. But that anger really has sort of subsided and sort of mellowed over the years. Although I also think, and one reason I wrote this book, is because we need to talk about suicide more. And we don't do that in this country when suicide is one of the leading causes of death.
Right.
And so part of me wants to use Mike's death to talk about it, to get the word out that it's okay to talk about suicide. In the book, I talk about in my teens and 20s, I had several suicide attempts. I had checked myself into several hospitals to get help. And it didn't really talk about it. It didn't talk about it with my family, who doesn't talk about Mike that much or the fact that he committed suicide. And we need to start talking about it.
Your suicide attempts, kind of transitioning into the family dynamic, was it related to specifically to your family and how you were raised? Were there other factors that were influencing those feelings of despair that you had?
Well, certainly. Those suicide attempts really came out when I was coming out as a gay man. And it was that very conflict. I talk about this in the book, I knew that my family hated gay people. They talked about it all the time. But they also confessed that they loved me as their child. But I couldn't reconcile those two positions. They hated gay, which I was, and they loved me. And that really conflict tore at me. And that's what I think pushed me to desperation. And my suicide attempts were really just cries for help. Mm-hmm. They weren't that serious attempts, as it were. They were cries for help, and it really, I think it was my brain telling me, you need help. I can't figure out the way to do it. I'm going to do this drastic measure in order to force myself to get help. And a lot of people who attempt suicide, this is what they're looking for, is help.
Your essays point out how difficult the relationship was with your father. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. My father, who's still alive, he's 89 years old, but he's been living with COPD for the last 10 years. So he's in his last days of his life. My father was a Trappist monk down in Kentucky. A Trappist monk is a monk who is cloistered. All their lives, they're not supposed to speak. They take vows. He didn't last very long in the monastery. He got out and within a year, he was married to my mother and started having children. And I like to say that my father may have left the monastery, but he did not leave monasticism. And that idea of monasticism sort of governed our family. And it was very difficult for me to live under that regime, under that idea. And so my relationship with my father has always been fraught. I'm working on a book now, it's called My Father's Body, in which I'm trying to reconcile that difference between us. So I have conversations with my father, especially now that he's so ill, and trying to figure out if gay sons and fathers can come to some sort of reconciliation in the end.
He was, you write in the book about you had this little parade every Sunday of you and all of your siblings going into church. It must have been a head turner, pretty perceptive for some people. But
yes.
I'm wondering, did you also have a fairly serious religious life at home?
Absolutely. My family was and still is a very religious Catholics, conservative Catholics, so that the household still is, was governed by Catholicism. And again, when I was growing up, and still to some degree now, of course, Catholicism viewed homosexuality as a great sin, and that put a lot of pressure on me, obviously, because, again, I knew from a very young age that I was gay, although my family didn't. So when they had, at the dinner table or just anywhere in the house, talking about gay people and disparaging them, I took it as a disparagement of me, their son, and their brother. And that was a difficult childhood to grow up in and to survive.
Do you think that your father was, to some extent, a product of his time and his environment and that experience you mentioned as a Trappist monk? And wasn't that Thomas Merton's?
That's exactly right. That's Thomas Merton. That's
Yeah. So I always think of that particular monastery as being liberal because of Merton's writings. But I don't know if that's true or not.
Maybe too liberal for him, for my father. Maybe that's why he left.
Yeah. So do you think he was a product of that, or did he have his own demons that pushed him further?
Well, I think that's true. I think that my father does represent a generation of men who never knew a gay person before. And certainly they were taught that homosexuality was terrible. So they had no other experience but that. So I certainly think his opinion comes from his time. But I also think it comes from who he is as a person as well. This calling he had to be a monk and then to be a very Catholic person, that's where he founded his identity. His whole identity was founded and still is in Catholicism. And I think it's very difficult for him to reconcile a gay son with his Catholicism.
We're speaking this morning with Andy Barnes. He is the author of the book, The Dark Eclipse, Reflections on Suicide and Absence. You can join our conversation if you have a question at 800-838-3760, or you can send us an email at jx@jeffnet.org. You speak in the book about how, back to this sort of, I don't know, macho or athletic position of so many of your brothers in the family, and you were the reader, you said,
in
your room.
That's right.
Did that just make things worse in your father's eyes?
Well, yes and no. In many ways, my father and my brothers, too, really had no idea what to do with me. I was such an odd kid that I preferred art and I preferred crafts, and I have this, I don't think I talk about it in my story, I may talk about it in this book. I once, when I was a teenager, went to the mall to get my hair cut, and the person cutting my hair said, "You should really get a perm, because your hair is so thin and fine." So I said, "Sure, I'll get a perm," and I did, and when I came home, you thought I would, you know, had done something horrific. My father especially was so appalled. I think he said something like, "I never thought a son of mine would do that." So I was a strange kid, and I was, I'm the middle child, and I'm the middle boy too. So I certainly had sort of middle child syndrome. I was an extremely moody kid. So one way my strangeness protected me, because my brothers were very aggressive towards each other. That's how we kind of, in an all male household. Almost all male, that's how we expressed ourselves, our affection, by hitting and wrestling and pushing and shoving. So in some sense, me in the corner doing knitting, it kind of left me alone. So that may have been the thing that saved me as opposed to my brother.
They were afraid of the needles, maybe.
That may have been.
Well, in the time you grew up, when you were a teenager, I was just thinking, didn't everybody have a perm back then?
Yeah, you and my father, those hippies. Oh, he hated those hippies.
What was your relationship like? Later I want to talk about your relationship with Mike, but what was your relationship like with your other siblings and with your mom?
It's interesting. There are 8 children born within 12 years.
Oh, my.
Oh, my, indeed. My poor mother. So you would think that we'd be very, very close, but we weren't particularly close. We are kind of clannish in the sense that we don't, I mean, we have a Scottish and Irish ancestry, so that clannishness, it comes natural to us. So we don't really like outsiders coming into the family. But we were not also a family that expressed our emotions or feelings towards each other. So I wasn't very close with my brothers, although in age I certainly was. And I'm still not that close. I'm certainly not that close with them now. With my mother, it's a different issue. I'm very close with my mother. I talk to her on a regular basis. And I think that because my mother understood that there was this friction and this chasm between my father and me. My father, who was a football player, extremely macho guy. Me, who was kind of a sissy in the family. And she tried, I think, most of her life to mediate that relationship between my father and me. So we had a very close emotional bond when I was younger, and still do to some degree.
Was she the peacemaker for the whole family?
Oh, yeah, she was the peacemaker of the whole family. But my mother's also an extremely strong person. So she was also the one that kind of ruled the household as well. You didn't go, and you still don't. You don't go against my mother.
So she wasn't passive in difficult family situations? Would she stand up to your father if she really thought he was wrong?
She might stand up, but again, we didn't have that many sort of fights in the household because we didn't. We a kind of family that avoid conflict at all costs, although there was a lot of tension underneath the surface. But she could stand up to my father easily and tell him no, as she did a couple times, as I talk about in the book.
Your relationship with Mike, as you talk about in the book, was kind of difficult, maybe in a different context than how it was with your father. Were there some similarities with your dad, or was it a different kind of difficulty with Mike?
I think it was a different kind of difficulty. My brother Mike was the golden child in our family. He was very smart, the smartest one in our family, according to some sort of a definition of smart, but he attended the University of Notre Dame. He went to Duke Law School. He was a lawyer on Wall Street. So he was the golden child. And I think that pressure being a golden child was part of why he had such a difficult time later on in life when he was confronted with difficulties. I was not the golden child. I was at the other end. I was the black sheep of the family. I was the B student. I was not that smart. The difference between us, sort of personality was different. Although I looked just like Mike, I sounded just like him, I had the same mannerisms. In fact, when I was growing up, most people called me Mike. So I was often confused for him. And we didn't know, at least I didn't know when we were younger, of course, that we were gay. We didn't know this until we were in our 20s. And I thought that when we came out, and we could talk about how that happened, it's an interesting story, that we would instantly become close because we were not just brothers now, we were gay brothers. And I really admired Mike. I really looked up to him, and I wanted to, he was kind of my hero, and I wanted to be close to him. But we could never get past the fact that we were brothers first.
Tell me a little bit about that story, about when you came out.
The coming out, yes. Yeah. That's one of the documents I use, although it's a document I've never seen. My brother and I, when we came out, I was living in Washington, D.C., and he was living in New York, and we'd come out to each other. And we promised that we would never tell our family, except one day Mike decided to handwrite a letter. I think it was 4 pages on a legal pad. He did that. He Xeroxed it. He didn't tell me he was doing this. Sent it to everyone in my family, and he came out in this letter. And at the end of this letter, he wrote, P.S., Andy is too.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, dear. Then he went on vacation. So he sent it, and then so when my family got it, they all called me.
Drop the bomb and run.
That was my brother Mike. He did that all the time. Dropped little bombs and ran away. So I had to deal with all their reaction to it. And then when Mike came home, he of course called me and said, "How did it go?" I was pretty furious with him. But that was typical of our relationship.
I want to ask, fast forwarding from the time of his death until you started this discovery process. Did the details at the time, with all of the years that had gone by, as you were getting these details and processing it, did that, at least in the short term, did that increase some of your personal pain or decrease it? Or were you kind of at that point in time able just to look at things objectively?
I think it, for a writing point of view, it was just a gold mine for me. All these facts that I didn't know these facts. I made assumptions about, I knew where Mike had died, but I assumed he died, and, you know, laying in a bed peacefully, you know, fully clothed, whatever. When I got the police report, I found out that no, he was found on his back next to the table where he was writing the note. And you'll see in the book that he can't, the note doesn't finish. It ends in gibberish because that's, I mean, he's quite literally writing his suicide note while he's dying.
And he, like, produced a cocktail of different things to make this happen.
That's right. And he had learned how to do this from a book from the Hemlock Society, which I had found in his apartment when I first went to New York. Mm-hmm. So I didn't, and he was in his underwear, too, which was an interesting, like, why? That was confusing to me. If you're going to die, you're going to be found. Why are you in your underwear?
Dress nicely.
Yeah, well, in the sense that your mother tells you always wear clean underwear because you never know what's going to happen, right?
Right.
So that was an odd detail that I didn't know. The other one that they talked about, he had put the chain lock on the door of the hotel, and my question was why.
Mm.
So these little nuanced things were good for me as I was beginning to write this book.
We're speaking with Andy Barnes this morning. His book is The Dark Eclipse, Reflections on Suicide and Absence. We'll be right back, and we'll have a further conversation with Andy this morning right after this short break. We are speaking this morning with Andy Barnes. He is the author of the book, The Dark Eclipse, Reflections on Suicide and Absence. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call at 800-838-3760 or send us an email at jx@jeffnet.org. Earlier, Andy, we talked about how you were the only one, along with your parents, who went to the morgue.
That's right.
And I'm wondering, did any of your family members show any interest over the years, either initially in 1993 or later, about the details of your brother Mike's suicide, or have they kind of remained distant from it?
They've remained distant from it. They, in one sense, they buried my brother and forgot about him. And there was, someone had said to me that because my brother had moved away from Indianapolis, and when we were growing up, the idea was that nobody leaves Indianapolis. In fact, in Indiana, there is a saying that when you're born, you're planted in the cornfields there, and you're expected to stay.
Mm-hmm.
And all my brothers, my other brothers and sister, and I have 19 nieces and nephews now, and almost all of them live there in Indiana. So we weren't really supposed to move. Mike and I had to move because the environment in which we grew up and which we were living was so oppressive that we couldn't survive. I certainly knew that I had to get out of Indianapolis or I would die. I had no doubt about that. So when Mike left, it was as if he had died already because he wasn't part of the family. He wasn't engaged where, you know, my family now, they go to my parents' house, my mother and father's house every Sunday.
Hmm.
So they all are still living that life of family. And those of us, and again, my family is very clannish in this sense. If you leave the clan, that's kind of, you know, a really bad thing, and you're kind of forgotten in some sense. So my parents or my brothers and my sister don't talk about Mike very much. They certainly don't talk about his suicide. I have in the past in years tried to talk to my family about suicide and my own suicide attempts, but it's not something they want to hear. And I think that part of it's because in this country and in the world, not just this country, there's a lot of shame associated with suicide, people who attempt suicide or who commit suicide. And the only way we can get rid of that shame is by talking about suicide. And the only way we can help people and save people is to start making suicide part of our dialogue in this nation and in this world.
You talk about, I want to ask another question about
sure.
the religious influence in your home. Do you think that contributed to the clannish sort of attitude, or was it just the dynamic of your family, or was some of that, a Midwestern type of ethic and view of the world?
I think it's all of the above. I think it's that. Yeah, I think it is. You know, in the neighborhood, interesting, where we grew up, we were the only Catholic family, and we were surrounded by Protestant families. And back in the 60s, 70s, 80s, that was really... one's religion, at least in my community, was core to who you were. And as Catholics back then, we believed, and some believe still now, that Catholicism is the only religion, and anyone who is not a Catholic is condemned. So because we were the only Catholic family in that neighborhood, we were closed off. We were clannish. But I think some of it also came from my family dynamics. My father, when he was younger, his father and his brothers moved to California, and my father felt very betrayed by that they left him. So I think when he had his own family, he really wanted them all to stay together, to stay close, and so he created this kind of clannish mentality. But also I think it is the Midwest, not just the Midwest, it is Indiana. There is a mentality in Indiana that Indiana is... the end all and the be all. There's nothing. You don't need to go anywhere else. You don't need to travel anywhere else. Indiana is it, which is a frightening idea. At least for me, it is.
Yeah, you don't want to venture even into Ohio or Illinois, do you?
Oh, heaven forbid, no.
You mentioned that you were the kid in the corner with the knitting needles.
Yes.
You obviously learned some coping strategies to stay under the radar in your
yeah.
home. And did that influence you in any kind of way as an adult? And do you think it was a negative influence that you really had to wrestle with in your early adult years? Or is it something that, you know, you're still in the corner with your knitting needles and you're happy and you're just fine with that, leave me alone kind of thing?
Well, I think that I did... Starting in my 20s, and I talk about this in the book, interesting, when I moved to California, to Southern California, to Laguna Beach, and I moved there because I wanted to do something that is called rewiring my brain. And really, it was to shock myself by putting myself in a completely different geographic location and topography in order to change the way I thought. In order to stop those tapes that I had learned growing up in the flatlands of India. And I did this on purpose because I really did believe, and I do believe, and it did, that dramatic shift from living in the flatlands to living on a cliff overlooking the Pacific Ocean in Laguna Beach allowed me to get distance from that past, distance from that location, and also, importantly for me, distance from my family. You see this a lot when if you know anyone who's an addict, they are told, get away from where you were an addict, get away from your hometown to change the environment. And for me, someone who had mental issues, someone who had committed attempted suicide a number of times, I needed that same kind of shock therapy. And what it allowed me to do is I created my own life on my own terms, which also allowed me to be a writer. In my family, you are not a writer. That's a silly little profession, like knitting in the corner,
now,
right?
Your dad's an accountant, right?
My dad's an accountant. Most of my brothers are accountants. My sister's an accountant.
One right answer.
Well, my undergraduate degree is in accounting. I had no other choice but to get it in accounting. So I followed that for a while. So I did purposely have to leave, and I still have a very strict boundaries around my life and around my family's life, in the sense that I don't know that any of my brothers, sisters, or my mother and father know that I've written this book. They weren't part of the writing of it. I have nieces and nephews who I'm very close to. They know, and they are very supporting of me and of my husband, who they've known their entire life. But I needed to keep that boundary because it's easy to get sucked back into the clan. It's like in the I always forget about this in Star Trek, the Borg. You know, you get plugged in and you can't get away. And
that's right.
I have to keep my distance. It's also like, you know, being around a planetary gravitational force. You can't get too close, you get sucked in.
You mentioned you're writing a book about your father, and you said you were calling him once a week or something like that.
I call him not once a week. I see him, if I see him twice a year, three times a year, that's a lot.
Okay.
So I don't see him a great, great deal, but I do see him, and I try to talk to him about really about his past. He knows nothing about his past, so I've been researching his past in order to kind of understand where he came from and why he created this world. In fact, two Memorial Days ago, I went to the Abbey of Gethsemane, where he was a Trappist monk, Thomas Merton's, and I went there in retreat to begin research on this book to try to understand my father.
I was going to ask if at this point in time there's been any reconciliation with your father. This sounds like a cruel question I'm about to ask, and it's not meant to be, but you referred to as COPD. And sometimes when people are near the end of their life and they have an opportunity to slowly slide into that, they don't have a sudden death.
That's right.
They really have some time to reflect. Has your dad done that? Have you seen any improvement in your relationship, or do you want an improvement in your relationship?
Those are both very good questions. My father and I, when we talk more, he is more open with me. Every once in a while, he can say "I love you," which is a very difficult thing for him to say. Always has been very difficult for him to say. But we don't talk about Mike. We don't talk about the curse he placed on me. We don't confront that. I think my father would deny it. I think he would say it never happened. Mm. My siblings certainly don't think it happened. They think I'm, you know, the weird kid with the wild imagination that's the writer. So they discounted this, although I was going to tell a story, but I'll pass on because it puts my father in a more cruel light, and I don't want to do that. So I don't know, and I don't think that I'm interested in, I'm not hoping for a deathbed sort of reconciliation,
right.
A confession. I'm not. The reason I'm writing the book that I'm writing, My Father's Body, I'm not trying to necessarily reconcile with the person called my father, that man that lives in Indianapolis. Mm. I'm trying to reconcile with those traits that I inherited from him that are part of me and accept those in me. I mean, I look in the mirror every morning and I see my father staring back at me, and that's difficult to confront. So this book is really about confronting those parts of you that contain your father or your parents and accepting those parts and accepting you, and perhaps also then accepting your parents as these flawed human beings.
One of your essays in the book is entitled Prospero's Books, and I wanted to get to that and have you to relate that to us, in part because I, as I read it, I thought, you know, this kind of transcends any issue of being gay. This is like, this sounds like family or friends that all of us have had at one point in another. Share that story with us.
I'm happy to, and I think you're right. You know, I talk about this as Mike and I were gay brothers, but we were brothers, and really the things I'm talking about here are happening a lot with brothers, and not just brothers, but men in general, because we tend to have a very difficult time forming and keeping positive relationships with other men, whether that's fathers, brothers, buddies, whatever. So back to your question, the Prospero's Books was a movie by Peter Greenaway, and it was based on The Tempest. And I happened to have, when I was living in Indianapolis, one of the ways I survived is that I joined the Indianapolis Shakespeare Summer Festival. And I talk about in there, over a period of a couple of summers, I was every minor character in every major play. So I was, you know, the page that ran on stage and yelled something and ran off, or someone in the background. But I got to, by doing that, I've got to understand Shakespeare and the language of Shakespeare. Indeed, my PhD is in Renaissance literature, Shakespeare, but also metaphysical poetry. So I took my brother, Mike came to visit me in Washington, D.C., and when he came to visit me in the past, he never really called me, so we didn't hang out. But this one time, he wanted to hang out with me, and I still don't know why. So I wanted to impress him, so I took him to Prospero's Books, which is a very difficult, dense movie to see.
Mm-hmm.
And so we sat in the movie theater, and it was a small little movie theater, and it was evident that Mike had no idea what was going on. And remember, I idolized Mike. He was the smart one. He was the one that knew everything. And I was the B student. I was the one that knew nothing. And we were sitting in this movie, and I loved it. I thought, I understand this completely. I get the story. I understand what he's trying to do, Greenaway's trying to do. And my brother was sitting, Mike was sitting next to me, fidgety and angry, you could feel it, that, about this movie he didn't understand. And when we came out of that movie, I had a realization that the kind of intelligence that was given to Mike, that was afforded Mike, that was lauded in Mike, was just a different kind of intelligence that I had. I had a creative intellect, and that was discounted in my family. And at that moment, I realized I didn't have to, after we got left Prospero's Books, I didn't have to live in my brother's shadow anymore. I could claim my own right to be smart in my own way, in my own area. And that was a drastic shift for me.
We only have about a minute left, and I wanted to wrap up. This is not an advice book in particular, but do you have a couple of quick things that you could suggest for that would help anybody who's going through this process with suicide?
Yeah, it's very important that listeners understand. First of all, if someone out there is suicidal right now, call an 800 number. There are 800 numbers for suicide hotlines, because you don't know what's going to happen tomorrow, and my life has turned out fantastic rather than dying. But also, we need to talk about suicide more. If you know someone that's suicidal, give them a call. Say hi to them today.
Help them out. Our guest has been Andy Barnes. He's the author of The Dark Eclipse, Reflections on Suicide and Absence. One final quick question, Andy. Dogs, cats, or neither?
Definitely dogs.
Okay. Well, thank you, and have a good day.
I appreciate it. Thank you.